Welcome back to Coast AM. And listen, we are opening up the phone lines now because it is going to be busy and you got to get in early. Get in line to speak with Daniel Sheehan. A photograph taken by the Opportunity Rover shows what appears to be a dome or a dome-top structure on the surface of Mars. I don't know if you guys have seen this. Go over to Coast to Coast AM and go to the news section. You can look at the pictures now. I've been looking at them all day today. They were taken on Sol 4073 back in July by the Opportunity Rover's panoramic camera. And it's easy to spot because you can see the dome on the edge of this hill. But it's not that the big dome, it's the small dome right next to it. It looks like there's a driveway. It is absolutely mind-blowing to see the images. Just go over to Coast to Coast AM, click on the Rover Finds Mysterious Dome on Mars. More with Daniel Sheehan right after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church. We're talking about the history, the forgotten history between the United States and the Middle East, and the rise of ISIS, and hopefully a way to prevent another 9/11 or a Paris situation in the future. Our guest tonight is Daniel Sheehan. Okay, Daniel, now we're right there with the Cold War and the common enemy. And before we run out of time, we've got to, we're going to spend the next hour taking calls. And the revelation that you are going to whip out at the bottom of the hour is going to be extraordinary, and I want to time it just right. So that's where we are right now. Let's pick it up where we left off.
Okay, so I think the key for us to focus on at the end of World War II is the power that this particular group of people had, the people that were the partner, the investment clients of Brown Brothers Harriman, the lawyers and Sullivan and Cromwell. That you understand that right at the end of World War II, there was a discovery that was made by Edward Lansdale, who was a member of the OSS, the Office of Special Services. He had been assigned to the Philippine Islands and was the G2, the head of Army Intelligence there. And he discovered that at the end of World War II, when the Japanese knew that in fact the United States was going to be invading the Japanese islands at the end of the war, that they had smuggled out of Japan billions and billions and billions of dollars of gold bullion, platinum, jewels and diamonds, et cetera, that had been pilfered by the Japanese military all through Southeast Asia, starting basically 10 years before World War II started. That entire period, there was a special military unit called the Golden Lily, and they were under the command of General Yakushima, and they gathered all this treasure together. And when they knew that the United States was going to be attacking the Japanese islands, they smuggled all of this treasure out of Japan, and they buried it in 175 troves in the Philippines. And the G2 for the U.S. Army, this guy Edward Lansdale, in 1945, at the end of World War II, he discovered that these troves were there, and he ended up torturing the driver of the actually the nephew of the emperor, who accompanied General Yakushima in the burying of all of these treasures. And they recovered 12 of them, which totaled amount of $1.2 trillion in gold, in platinum, and silver bullion, in jewels. And what happened is Lansdale flew from the Philippines, flew to Singapore, met with General MacArthur, and told him about this. MacArthur assigned his chief of intelligence, a man by the name of Charles Willoughby, to go with Lansdale to fly all the way back to Washington, D.C., to meet with Truman and tell him that they had found this $1.2 trillion in gold and silver and platinum and jewels, to find out what to do with it. And so they had this meeting. Lansdale flew to Washington along with General Charles Willoughby, and they went in and had a meeting with Truman. Truman brings in his Secretary of War, Henry Stimson, and he brings in two partners from Brown Brothers Harriman, Robert Lovett, and Anderson, Charles Anderson, and they Robert Anderson, and they bring them in and they set up a secret trust. They don't put the money into the American Treasury. They don't put the money under the American government's control. They put it under the control of two of the partners from Brown Brothers Harriman, and they put the money in the Swiss banks, and they issue gold certificates, and they use them to finance putting fascists into power all through Europe. The people who had been former members of the Nazi Party, who had been opponents of the partisans, who were opposing the fascists in Germany, that there was a decision made right at the end of World War II by the head people of the Office of Special Services that they were going to form an alliance with the former Nazis, and that they and were going to be opposing the Soviet Union, who were communists. What this was simply a continuation of the same kind of policies that were under the control of George Herbert Walker and his partners in Brown Brothers Harriman and Sullivan and Cromwell. They just continued that same kind of opposition to the Soviets, and that they focused on that at the end of World War II and basically commenced the Cold War against them.
How were the, let me jump in really quick. How was the Council of Foreign Relations and the Trilateral Commission at this point involved?
Well, they're actually some of the same, the younger generation, the sons of the members of the private investment firm of Brown Brothers Harriman and the lawyers in Sullivan and Cromwell, that David Rockefeller, actually, they began a Council on Foreign Relations, but the Council on Foreign Relations has, hundreds and hundreds of people in it. It's not this kind of tight-knit, super powerful group of people like that were in Brown Brothers Harriman and Sullivan and Cromwell. Virtually every Democratic Party official and every Republican Party official and every CEO for major business corporations, they all participate in the Council on Foreign Relations. And it's perfectly clear that they carry on a very, very conservative, anti-communist, pro-capitalist position. But the real power resides in the group that was set up after World War II, because what happened is Galen, I mentioned, Reinhard Galen, the head of the anti-Soviet and anti-Eastern Bloc intelligence for the Third Reich, turned himself in to the Office of Special Intelligence and Special Services. They ended up getting him appointed to be the head of anti-Soviet intelligence for the entire NATO nations, for the entire Western allies, and they based him in West Germany. And he set up a base there in West Germany, and the OSS set up a special office there. And in the office was not only Theodore Shackley, who was the translator for Galen and his deputy, but also Alan Dulles was there. And John J. McCloy, who was one of the three people who were the trustees of the Anderson Trust, of John McCloy and Robert Lovett and Robert B. Anderson. That McCloy was appointed to be the Governor General of Germany, and Shackley stayed there as a deputy to Galen, and you had a whole group of people in that office there. They were the precursors of the Central Intelligence Agency, and they were set right there in amongst all of those fascists. And what they did is Galen set up a special academy at Oberammergau in the Bavarian mountains, and he put in charge of that academy a fellow by the name of Major General Otto Skorzeny, who was the head of the Waffen-SS Special Forces. To give you some idea who this guy was.
Right.
And he ended up setting up this academy, and they trained 1,200 men from all of the Western allies starting at the end of World War II. They trained 1,200 men over the years, and they were under the control of Otto Skorzeny, who was this rabid fascist, and they basically were a progeny of the old Order of the Castles, the Ordensbergen, that had been set up in Germany by the fascists to train SS officers. And 1,200 men were trained, and they were trained from every country in the Western culture, including Israel, which was now set up at the end of World War II. And so that you had these men, 1,200 men that were trained, that were more loyal horizontally to each other than they were vertically loyal to the particular executive of the country from where they came from. So they were you had a whole set of these people trained who were fascists. And they were inside the intelligence communities all around the Western powers, and they set up a national security state. They were taking their lead basically from the Germans that they had helped escape from Europe and put in Argentina, in Bolivia, in Brazil, etc., who were ensconced in power down there in Argentina. And what they did is they were the ones pushing the buttons. But the people, remember, the people who created them were George Herbert Walker and his partners in Brown Brothers Harriman and in Sullivan and Cromwell. This is the group of people that basically were running things from behind the scenes, and they were the ones administering this $1.2 trillion in secret gold funds that were actually financing the selection of governors and mayors and stuff all through Europe under the Truman Doctrine, in which they said we cannot allow the reins of government in any European country to fall into the hands of the communists, even if it is the will of a majority of their own people. And so that they were in complete defiance of any kind of sense of democracy, and that they were installing fascists all through Europe. And all through Latin America, and also in Japan and in Asia. And so this is all being done privately, but they then start advocating. Robert Lovett, who's one of the three trustees for the Anderson Trust of all this secret gold, what they're doing is they're advocating that to Truman that he set up a new private intelligence organization to oppose communism. And that's where the Central Intelligence Agency comes from. And the group of people that were involved in setting up the Central Intelligence Agency were all of these same people. Robert Lovett and William D. Pauley, a major fascist who was in fact the first ambassador to Bolivia to coordinate with the fascists at the end of World War II. It was a big magnate that owned sugar mills and things in Cuba, and was a business partner of Batista. You know, so that this is a group of men. We're talking about basically, you know, 60 to 70 men who were in power and in control. And that they've their sons have been trained into taking some of their places. You know, so that David Rockefeller stepped up and took the place of Harriman. Harriman's people, his sons came up. Rockefeller's sons came up. Prescott Bush's sons came up. You know, all of these people have been brought up into positions of there. It's an elite, aristocratic, royalist class of people. And they're just exactly like the royalists in the European nations that we tried to escape from and set up a democratic country here in the United States. So these people are fundamentally anti-democratic, they're fascist, and they're authoritarian. They do not believe in the egalitarian principles of our Constitution. They don't believe in the existence of fundamental individual human rights. They believe that they're an elite aristocracy. They are the 1%. And people are starting to get some vague sense of the fact that there is this 1% of the people who own the major stock in the corporations and are manipulating all the policies of our country. And the one of the most dominant of all of these industries, of course, is the petroleum industry. And that those people who were the owners of the stock of the seven major oil companies that were in the Arab American oil corporations, the Aramco, you know, these are the people that are wagging the dog. You know, there's this long story that we talked about, we talked earlier about what it is that George Herbert Walker Bush did when he was president from 1988 to 1992. As soon as he got wind in 1990 of the fact that the Soviet Union was probably going to be dissolving within a year, that he basically set up this entire process by sending this handwritten memo to Saddam Hussein telling Saddam Hussein that if in fact Saddam Hussein found it necessary to resort to the use of military power against Kuwait on his southern border because of them slant drilling under his border and stealing his oil, that George H.W. Bush would not view that as being contrary to the long-term interests of the United States. And as soon as Saddam Hussein went ahead per this prompt or set up 10,000 people, military people on the border, his southern border, the northern border of Kuwait, and planned to invade them, his Secretary of Defense, Dick Cheney, contacted the foreign minister from Saudi Arabia to the United States, Prince Bandar, called him over to the West Wing and showed him photographs of Saddam Hussein assembling his military, getting ready to invade Kuwait, and flat out lied to Prince Bandar and said, we in the United States had credible intelligence indicating that Saddam Hussein, once he went into Kuwait and occupied it, was going to go on into Saudi Arabia and overthrow the House of Saud. And so he insisted that they invoke an old 1972 treaty pursuant to which the House of Saud, at that time King Faisal, but now King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah, that they would agree to abide by a 1972 treaty that was signed secretly with Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger, that they would invite the United States in to occupy the Middle Eastern oil fields to prevent the Soviet Union or China from invading and occupying the oil fields. Well, they invoked the old treaty, even though it wasn't the Soviet Union or China. It was Saddam Hussein.
How many months, Danny, I need to jump in before we hit this break. Yeah. How many months was this after the fall of the Soviet Union?
This was actually just in the just as they got the information in June and July of 1990. This was basically 18 months before the Soviet Union officially dissolved.
Right, and they knew that it was coming. They knew it was coming. Yeah. And when the invasion happened, well, this is what's fascinating to me at this point, is they saw the writing on the wall, and knew that they had to keep a common enemy, to keep the military and industrial, the oil money flowing.
They had to have an ultimate other, because you need to understand these people are dialecticians. They work off a dialectic. Their whole source of self-valuing is their ability to vanquish some ultimate other. They don't have any kind of positive. They can't go around advertising. They're just trying to make as much money as they can conceivably make for themselves. You know, what they're doing is they're constantly generating an enemy, just like out of George Orwell in 1984. And so that as soon as they realized they were starting to lose the Soviet Union as their ultimate other, the rationale that they've been using for 80 years to spend billions of dollars generating huge, massive amounts of military armament that are all made by their own corporations, you know? And so that what they did is they've generated a new alternative other, which is the terrorists. That they went in and occupied the Middle Eastern oil fields, and when in fact the people that were there, the Sunnis, the Sunni radicals that constituted the Muslim Brotherhood that had been around since 1922, opposing foreign military occupation of the Holy Lands, that's who they're dealing with here. They're dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood. They're not dealing with ISIS or Al-Qaeda.
Let me jump in. We're up against a hard break. Tonight, Daniel Sheehan, we're talking about the lost history between the United States and the Middle East and the rise of ISIS. When I come back, I'm going to ask the question, did the premature withdrawal from Iraq by the U.S. lead to the rise of ISIS? I know the answer. He's going to do it when we come back. More with Daniel Sheehan right after this. You can catch George Norrie's internet TV show. It's called Beyond Belief, for dynamic discussions on the paranormal, phenomena, conspiracy, and all things unexplained. You can check out the preview right now with Corey Good. Just go to coasttocoastam.com. It's right there on the homepage. You can sign up for just 99 cents for the first month, and you can enjoy hours of fascinating past shows. Just go to beyondbelief.com. Tonight, we're talking with Daniel Sheehan and the lost history between the United States and the Middle East, and it's about to get heavy. More with Daniel Sheehan right after this. Welcome back to Coast AM. I'm your host tonight, Jimmy Church, and we're talking with Daniel Sheehan about the lost history between the United States and the Middle East, the forgotten history, the relationship, how it started and where it was built. And Daniel, we are at right now, we're at that, you brought us to the critical aha moment with Dick Cheney and the Saudi royal family. Yeah. Bush is in office, and now the game is played. Let's pick it up.
This is how it happened. It turns out in late June of 1990, this is now approximately 18 months before the Soviet Union officially dissolves, that the intelligence data started coming in to the Bush administration, George H.W. Bush's single term from 1988 to 1992. Now, this is 2 years before the end of his term in 1990. In late June, he starts getting intelligence data indicating that the Soviet Union might actually officially dissolve with Gorbachev. And as you remember, I was one of the directors at Gorbachev's State of the World Forum in the New Paradigm Institute there. And so I've had conversations with him about this. One of my best friends in the whole world, Dr. James Garrison, who was my best friend at Harvard Divinity School, was the head of the Gorbachev Foundation. And he was my staff person at the Jesuit National Headquarters on nuclear weapons policy. And so we are very familiar with this, that Gorbachev was engaged in all kinds of actions, perestroika and glasnost, that were moving toward liberalizing the Soviet Union. And as this information started coming into Bush in late June of 1990, he began to panic that they were going to lose their ultimate other, and they were not going to be able to justify the then $350 billion a year on military, which is now up to $612 billion a year. And so what he did, I mentioned it quickly, what he did is he prepared a handwritten memo, which he gave to April Gillespie, who was the United States ambassador to Iran, to Saddam Hussein. In this memo said specifically, it said, look, I know that you've been having difficulty with Kuwait on your southern border, and you believe that they are slant drilling under your border and stealing Iraqi oil. And I would like to let you know personally that if you find it necessary to resort to the use of military force against them, that I would not view that as contrary to the long-term best interests of the United States. And obviously, Saddam Hussein took that as a clear prompt from George H.W. Bush to go and use military force against Kuwait, which he did. And as I say, he began to assemble his military forces along the southern border of Iraq and the northern border of Kuwait. And Dick Cheney, who was the Secretary of Defense for George H.W. Bush, he immediately sent for Prince Bandar, who was the ambassador to the United States from Saudi Arabia, invited him to the West Wing of the White House in late June of 1990, and showed him real-time NSA photographs, satellite photographs of Saddam Hussein assembling his military along the border, preparing to invade Kuwait. And he said, you see, we have very good intelligence indicating to us that he's going to invade Kuwait, and we have equally sound intelligence that he's going to be invading Kuwait, and once he occupies them, he's going to go into Saudi Arabia and overthrow the House of Saud, because they know that the people hate you, your people there, because of all these princes running around, whoring around Europe and gambling in casinos and living these profligate lifestyles. And there's an entire Sunni Shiite majority in Saudi Arabia that are quite conservative religiously, and they're totally offended by the conduct of the royal family. And so that the bottom line is Saddam Hussein is going to be going in and invading your country. And we want to invoke the old August 1972 treaty that was secretly signed by Richard Nixon, and Henry Kissinger on their way back from their secret mission to China when they were on the SR-71 that were flying back. They stopped off in Saudi Arabia.
Are you there?
I'm here.
Okay, we've got a little phone system.
There you go.
Okay, we're good. We're good. That was strange. That came out of nowhere. Okay.
So the bottom line is that Dick Cheney lied flat out to Prince Bandar, made up this entire story about the fact that Saddam Hussein was going to be coming in and invading Saudi Arabia. But he said, I want to invoke this old treaty that was signed between King Faisal back in 1972 with Richard Nixon on the way back from China, in which they signed an agreement that Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger would agree to allow Saudi Arabia and Iran, under the Shah of Iran, to renew the 60-year exclusive lease agreement. Here we are. See, we come full circle again. And the 60-year exclusive lease agreement was getting ready to run out. It wouldn't have run out for another 5 or 6 years, but Richard Nixon and Henry Kissinger wanted to take advantage to get out ahead of that and say, look, let's secretly renew the contract so that you can raise the price of oil from 42 cents a gallon at the pump, which it is now, that you're getting for each gallon of gas, you now will get $1.42 per gallon. But the agreement is that you have to use that additional dollar a gallon at the pump to do a number of things. First, you have to use some of that money to buy military equipment from U.S. military manufacturers, such as the AWACS airborne radar. You have to use the over-the-horizon radar. You have to buy F-15s from the United States military suppliers. So that's one of the three things you have to do. The second thing that you have to do is you have to use some additional amount of that $1 a gallon, the additional amount you're going to be allowed to raise the prices for your gas for. You have to use some of that money to dredge out a number of harbors here in Saudi Arabia so that the United States warships can come into your harbors, and you have to use another part of it to build major landing strips, military landing strips, for airlifting U.S. military in barracks and stuff for U.S. military forces. So, and the third thing you need to do is that if, in fact, either the Soviet Union or China, either one of them makes a faint toward occupying the Middle Eastern oil fields, that you need to then invoke this treaty and call us and invite us in, and we'll bring our warships in to occupy these harbors, and we'll come in and occupy these military bases, and we'll protect the Middle Eastern oil fields against invasion and occupation from either the Soviet Union or China. Now, obviously, neither one of those two parties was going to invade the Middle East there in 1990, but George H.W. Bush and Cheney and his people had set up this process where Saddam Hussein was clearly going to be going into Kuwait because he had this regional local problem with them, but he wasn't going into Saudi Arabia, but they lied and said that he was. And so that so as soon as they verified that he'd gone in and invaded and occupied Kuwait, they invited Dick Cheney to come to Saudi Arabia. He went to the royal palace. He had an all-morning meeting with King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah in August, early August of 1990, and he invoked the treaty. And he said, look, we want you to invite us in to occupy the Middle Eastern oil fields to protect them against Saddam Hussein. We'll agree to drive Saddam Hussein out of Kuwait, and we will protect you so that he won't come in and invade you guys. And what we want to do is we want to have you invite us to come in. And what happened is when he left the meeting, King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah were considering that. But Turki bin Faisal, who was the chief of security of the House of Saud, had been so for 26 years, that he found out about the meetings. And so he asked for a short meeting with King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah. And he said, look, please do not invite the infidels into the Holy Land. If you invite them in, they're going to, in fact, stay. They won't leave. They'll come up with some excuse. And so don't do this. Please give me a chance to offer an alternative. Let me have a meeting with you tomorrow morning at 10 o'clock. And what I'll do is I'll agree to bring our forces in here and protect you. Okay? So what Turki bin Faisal said is, I'll offer you an alternative. So the next morning, he goes in and he holds a meeting. He brings with him Khalil Mahfouz, who is the head of the Royal Saudi Family Bank, and he brings with him Mohammed Barum, who is the heir to the wealthiest family in Saudi Arabia. They own all the steel mills and the cement factories and stuff. And they come in and they said, look, do not do this. Do not invite the infidels in. We have an alternative. And they turn, they open the door, and in walks Osama bin Laden. Osama bin Laden, who has been the best friend of Turki bin Faisal, the chief of security for the House of Saud, since they were 4 years old, right? And he invites him in. He said, look, so Osama bin Laden has 10,000 battle-hardened mujahideen troops sitting up in the Khyber Pass, and they've just gotten through kicking the crap out of the Soviet Union and driving them out of Afghanistan, and they're perfectly willing to drive Saddam Hussein back up into Iraq and drive them out of here. You don't need to invite the infidels in. And Osama bin Laden stands there, sponsored by Turki bin Faisal and Mohammed Barum and Khalil Mahfouz, and he lays out charts and stuff and shows how he can do this for like an hour and a half in the meeting with Turki bin Faisal sponsoring him. And they get to the end of the meeting, and King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah are considering his alternative offer. But it turns out Dick Cheney was still at the palace and realized that this meeting had taken place. He comes back in and asks for a second meeting. And he comes back in and he meets with King Fahd and Crown Prince Abdullah. And he said, look, I have a sweetener for the deal here for you. And listen to what he offered him. He said, listen, in addition to our agreeing to come in and protect you against being invaded by Saddam Hussein and ousted from power, we will agree if you invite us in, invite us in to occupy the oil fields, we'll protect you, the House of Saud, from your own people. Because these fundamentalist, conservative Sunni Muslims hate you, as I told you before. They hate you and the royal family and all the crown princes and everything. And the fact is that you need to be protected against your own people, these fundamentalist Sunni Muslims that constitute the Muslim Brotherhood. And that when he made that offer to them, King Fahd, actually Crown Prince Abdullah, accepted it and invited them to come in. He allowed them to invoke the old August 1972 treaty, and invited them to come in. And so George H.W. Bush ran around and got a couple other volunteers, I guess, you know, like... I guess New Zealand and in Australia and a couple other of the willing nations, and said that he was forming a coalition, and they mounted a major invasion of the Middle Eastern oil fields.
What do you do about? Well, let me jump in, Daniel, before we hit this break. What do you do when you have somebody that says, "I'm a student of history, and I know what I have been told, and we did not give Saddam a green light to invade Kuwait"?
Well, it's a simple interpretation of the memo that was hand delivered to him by April Gillespie, and we've got a copy of it. I was given a copy of it, so I know what it said, you know. And I've got copies of it at the office. People can contact us, you know. That this is what I do. I mean, that's why I was asked to be chief counsel for the Jesuits. That's why I ran the Christic Institute for a dozen years in Washington D.C. you know, that they can contact us at the Romero Institute. We have a romeroinstitute.org website, and they can contact us on the Romero Facebook. We can put the documents up there. You know, most people aren't interested in the particular details of these. I give people the details.
Right.
And say, look, and just like you know, we know that the Bush, what happened is immediately after the Soviet Union dissolved. Well, of course, they go in and occupy the Middle Eastern oil fields and drive Saddam Hussein back up into Kuwait. And just as Osama bin Laden had told them, they refused to leave. They say, well, we're going to leave Saddam Hussein in power, but we need to have a no-fly zone. And it's going to take 250,000 U.S. military personnel based full-time in the Middle Eastern oil fields and the Holy Lands to administer the no-fly zone. And so they left them right there. So Osama bin Laden, you know, said, look, that's exactly what I told you they're going to do. And so what he did is he mounted a jihad to drive them out of the Holy Lands. And he mounted the attacks against the two African embassies of the United States, at Dar es Salaam and the other one. He supervised the attack on the USS Cole in Yemen. He was behind the first, you know, smudge bomb that they put in the bottom of the trade towers. They also attacked the U.S. Marine bases in Saudi Arabia. You know, he began a jihad using what it is he could do to drive them out. And that's what this whole thing has been about. This is the Muslim Brotherhood. This is not Al-Qaeda, and it's not, you know, the ISIS, and it's not that they keep trying to come up with some little subgroup pretending that they can just knock off the leadership of some little small group or even knock out, you know, a few people. There's 200,000 members of the Muslim Brotherhood, and they're radical Sunni Muslims, and that they hate the House of Saud, and they hate the fascist potentates that have been put into power by the Western powers at the end of World War One, you know, and they're not going to stand for this. And so the bottom line is that it isn't ISIS, you know, it isn't us withdrawing troops too early out of one of the countries, out of Afghanistan or out of Iraq.
Right.
You know, it isn't none of those things the cause. The cause of it is going in and occupying the Middle Eastern oil field.
You know, Daniel, we're going to be up against a break, and we're going to be taking calls after the break, and all of the lines are jammed, and we're going to get to everybody. I promise we're going to get everybody's questions in tonight. But one has to ask, why did Dick Cheney get away with a get-out-of-jail-free card? That's the question that I have. Tonight, Daniel Sheehan, the secret history between the United States and the Middle East. This is Coast to Coast AM. I'm your host, Jimmy Church, taking your calls next. Stay right there.